Immigration officials are still detaining and deporting people. How will that impact our fight against this coronavirus? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Immigration courts are still busy, and so are ICE agents. Farm workers are considered essential, but a portion of these folks are undocumented.
We've seen notices that community health clinics will not be targets of ICE enforcement operations.
How the issue of immigration is being handled during the fight against the pandemic. Also, a doctor at the University of Miami tried a different process to help a coronavirus patient with severe symptoms, and the patient has recovered. Could nitric oxide replace the need for ventilators? Finally,
my mom said she'll wear her dress.
The dress that she was going to wear to your wedding here.
Yes.
Getting married during a global pandemic. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, the streets of South Florida have been pretty empty. That is because, of course, health and government officials have urged residents to stay at home. But not everyone can afford to skip work like many in immigrant communities. For example, here in South Florida, many migrants work the farm fields. They're essential workers, and they're the people who supply a lot of the produce that we eat every day. Today, we wanted to take a look at how this community is dealing with the coronavirus. Joining us now is Alina Santana, a local immigration attorney, and she's also the vice president of South Florida's chapter of American Immigration Lawyers Association. It is a pleasure. Alina, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. Tim, always great to have you.
And it's great to be here, Lewis.
And Maria Rodriguez is with the Florida Immigration Coalition. This is an organization that has a hotline for people who are undocumented and have questions. Maria, thanks for the time today.
Good afternoon, everybody.
So Florida has issued this stay-at-home order, but as I mentioned, a lot of the immigrant community can't afford to do that. They often have essential jobs. Tim, in this week's LATAM, you introduced us to one of these essential workers, Paulino Gallegos. Who is he?
Well, he's a native Mexican who came here from Michoacan, Mexico, about 21 years ago. He's undocumented, as you pointed out, but he does work in what is now designated as an essential sector, agricultural work here in South Dade in the Redlands. He does food picking and nursery work, and he's has a family here that he has a child who's a U.S. citizen. He has another daughter who's has immigration protection under DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and he is very active in his community. As I said, he has more than 20 years established here as a resident, and he's as I said, and one of those essential workers now.
Let's take a listen to him real quick.
Pues yo no tengo récord así criminal, yo reporto, pues pago mis impuestos desde el 2001, todos los años he pagado. Y yo pienso que la mejor me puede ayudar.
So Tim, what is he saying there?
Well, what he's pointing out is that he is one of the, quote, non-criminal undocumented immigrants that the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency last month said it was going to hold off on detaining, arresting during this pandemic. And he, you know, points out that he does not have a criminal record. He pays his taxes. As I mentioned, he's very active in his community. He helps organize soccer tournaments down in Florida City. And he has very strong family connections here. So he is one of those non-criminal undocumented immigrants that ICE said it was going to curtail arrests of during this crisis, and that's why he and a lot of other people are sort of confused as to why he was then detained last month.
I've always been curious with the undocumented population that we have, how well informed they are of the news, and how, you know, with Paulino, how well informed is he about everything that's going on right now?
Well, he was well informed. He had heard that, in fact, the same day that ICE made that announcement that it was going to be curtailing arrests of non-criminal undocumented immigrants, that was the same day that he was picked up. He had heard the news, and so he was all the more surprised then when they did detain him. He's what's called a collateral detainee because he was happened to be with an undocumented immigrant who did have a detain order, who was a target of detention. And just because Paulino happened to be sort of standing beside this other person, Paulino himself was then locked up.
Just a lot of bad luck in that situation. Alina, yes. I mean, so look, Alina, Tim tells us that we thought under this pandemic there would be some changes, that there would be something different about how ICE and how immigration in general would be handled. But, I mean, should immigrants be concerned about being detained and deported, even in a pandemic?
You know, there have been some changes, but I do not think they've been extensive enough. And yes, I do still think people should be worried. ICE did make that announcement that they would be curtailing the amount of non-criminal people. However, simultaneously, we're hearing reports that the number of detainees actually increased in our detention centers in the first couple of weeks of all of this. And we have constant reports from immigration attorneys, especially locally, that they're trying to get some of their more vulnerable health vulnerableness clients out and are not having luck getting them out of detention. We're also seeing courts getting postponed, court hearings, so bond hearings getting postponed. So there's mixed signals coming from ICE right now as to exactly how much they're doing to prevent detaining additional people. And there's some serious due process concern with those who are detained.
Let's talk about the courts. So the courts are still operating.
The court is not closed. EOIR is alive, open, and well. They have suspended in-person appearances for non-detainees. That means if you have a court hearing in immigration court this week, it's been suspended and postponed for now. But the court itself is still working, which means that deadlines in court are still valid. You still need to meet those deadlines, and attorneys are still filing in, at the window or by mail, anything that there are deadlines that need to be met. For detained individuals, court has proceeded as normal. They've been suspending hearings here and there when there's been reports of someone testing positive. For example, here in Chrome Immigration Court, which is our closest one here in South Florida in Miami, we are seeing that they're canceling on a day by day and they're playing it by ear based on what's going on, but they have not actually implemented a full closure.
And you're still meeting with clients, right?
We are. You know, as much as possible, we're meeting via telephone and internet and Skype and Zoom and all those other fun alternatives that I feel like I'm teaching all my clients to use.
Yeah.
But sometimes we have no choice. You know, sometimes I have no choice but to tell someone to come on by and drop something off or come sign some paperwork.
Right.
So I am still meeting with them, not as frequently, but for the ones that I absolutely have to, I have no choice.
Yeah. Maria, talking about that hotline, I'm wondering the types of questions that you typically hear from people. What are they asking most right now?
Yeah, the Florida Immigrant Coalition hotline has varied in different peaks and flows. But in the last 3 weeks, we initially got a lot of questions around COVID-19 and healthcare. We immediately translated the Florida Surgeon General's clarifying statement that documentation would not be criteria for testing. And we're right now looking at some of the testing sites that are requiring IDs to circumvent some of that for those who normally would qualify for that type of testing. So healthcare has been one key area. And then after the federal action, and as you know, April 1st comes and the rent is due, many, many calls around what to do and financial assistance. Thankfully, in Miami-Dade, there's been a moratorium for the next 45 days on evictions. But then the constant calls are around family separation and that parents that could be and should be with their children and families are is still in detention. This is civil confinement that puts their lives at risk, and that when we must be doing social distancing, we still have detention centers. As Elena just mentioned, BTC, there's an average of 30-plus detainees coming in every day, and that's just wrong. And so we're working to get ICE and the congressional delegation to look at those issues of continued and increased attention. Today, the paper mentioned a deportation flight to Haiti, which is absolutely immoral. So those are the types of questions.
Yeah, the Miami Herald story. Correct. Yes. We're talking with Maria Rodriguez. She's with the Florida Immigration Coalition. Also, Alina Santana, a local immigration attorney and the vice president of South Florida's chapter of American Immigration Lawyers Association. And also WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett, joining us. Recently, the Trump administration enacted a new policy called the Public Charge Rule. This is causing some confusion. Alina, can you clear it up for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So the public charge rule is about people using certain benefits and thus them becoming non-desirable immigrants, for lack of a better term. Now, with everything going on for COVID-19, USCIS did announce on March 13th that the agency would not consider, quote, testing, treatment, nor preventable care related to COVID-19 in any public charge determinations for anyone applying for a green card. But there's a big however to this, right? Because they may not actually consider you going to get medical treatment, but USCIS does consider the receipt of certain cash or non-cash public benefits, including some that may be used to obtain testing or treatment when they decide on public charge inadmissibility grounds. So there is still a concern because those public benefits that they do consider could include things like Medicaid, formerly food stamps, and things like that, which, while are not directly related with the testing right now, absolutely are related in that people are losing their jobs and seeking more and more benefits.
So it was, for example, like if you had a green card or a visa and you were seeking out certain benefits like food stamps, I think, as you had pointed out, that could affect your ability then for citizenship. But under the pandemic, under the situation that we're in, you know, is that still the case then, basically, that if you need any of these services, whether it's unemployment or food stamps or anything, that you have that concern?
Well, so it's more about applying for residency than it is about citizenship.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Public charge grounds are for a residency test.
Thank you.
And there's actually a big distinction drawn. Unemployment is considered an earned benefit. So generally, that's not a problem. You can go and you can get your unemployment, or so we've been told so far.
Right.
But other things like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly called food stamps, cash assistance for income maintenance, Section 8 housing, for example, for anyone who does end up leaving their homes for lack of funds, those kinds of things are absolutely considered under the public charge rules. So while they may not be directly related with your health, you can absolutely see how they are related at the end of the day if you're losing your job and losing income.
It, by the way, I thought you don't have to have a social security number to get your benefits?
You do. You have to be in some sort of lawful status. But a lot of our people are visa holders.
Right.
We're talking about people who are here temporarily, or they have pending residency and thus have a social security number. So we are talking about people applying for a green card. And generally, you don't qualify for these benefits if you're completely undocumented. But there are some benefits that, for example, U.S. citizen children or spouses would qualify for that would be taken into effect. So while you cannot directly be penalized for a U.S. citizen family member seeking benefits, it is something taken into account for some of the more discretionary applications. For example, some of the defensive things we do in court, we have to declare if you have kids who've been receiving benefits and whether you're able to care for them, whether your spouse actually has enough income to petition for you if you're doing something like that. So there are some indirect concerns, despite the rule being clear that they shouldn't affect you. Other people in your family who are in status receiving benefits shouldn't directly affect you.
Maria, you know, this comes back to the idea of, again, you know, this portion of our population, what do they know? What kind of information they have access to? If they're not reaching out to your hotline, is all of that information available to them, especially in their language?
Well, now there's a lot of information and misinformation. And in terms of language, for example, we immediately had to translate a lot of the basic information in 10 different languages. If anybody uses Linktree, you can find our information at Linktree/Flick. It's the Florida Immigrant Coalition. But our community is well informed, and we work very arduously to make sure that we do inform folks in through different platforms. So if we don't get a text or a call through the Flick hotline, which I'm glad to give the number later, we'll get a message through the Facebook Messenger or we'll get an email. And I think our community is very informed. And sometimes they think they have rights that that they enjoy in their home countries that they don't enjoy here. And sometimes they don't know about the rights they do have. Right now, we're looking at a lot of worker rights issues that are coming up that there's lots of discrepancies around.
Yeah. And yeah, we can get that number from you and make sure to share it on our social media, on our website as well. Tim, another person you spoke with was Oscar Londoño. I hope I'm saying that right.
Mm-hmm.
He heads the immigrant advocacy NGO We Count. It's in Homestead.
Right.
And he talked about local community health clinics, which are what uninsured immigrants mostly depend on. Let's take a listen.
We've seen notices that community health clinics will not be targets of ICE enforcement operations, but there are these questions and lack of trust lingering in the minds of many undocumented immigrants as to how safe is it.
So, you know, the farm workers, Tim, like the ones in your story, they work in tight spaces in some cases, or they work in bunches, so they're at risk because of the exposure. But what did Oscar tell you about the community of farm workers that he advocates for and how they're trying to, if at all, practice social distancing and protect themselves?
Well, one of the things that they're trying to get during this particular time is, for example, more protective equipment, things like masks. I mean, if you're out in a green bean field down in the Redland, and you're going to be working in rows with, you know, 20 or 30 other migrant workers harvesting vegetables, you're probably going to want some kind of mask for your nose and your mouth yourself, just as you would want it, for example, in a grocery store or a Publix here, to ward off transmission of COVID-19. That's the kind of things that they're asking their employers, you know, to provide. And they're also, you know, just wanting assurances, as Oscar there pointed out, that if they do get sick, if they do have to avail themselves of the of public services like public health clinics, public food pantries, et cetera, they want to know that they're not going to be targets for ICE enforcement at places like that if they've gotten sick because of, again, of being exposed to transmission to the virus while they're at work or while they're living in tight quarters, as we mentioned, that is often the case with migrant worker camps. Those can be very crowded as well. So they're looking for assurances like that during this time because, again, we go back to that irony that while, you know, the federal government is calling farm workers essential workers right now during this period, at the same time, we have to appreciate the fact that up to 70% of farm workers in this country are undocumented.
You know, it comes back to that question I had about how much do these folks know about what's going on. And I'd imagine if, especially if they're, you know, like, you know, with Paulino, that he just speaks mostly Spanish. I take it only Spanish.
Just about. Yeah.
Yeah. That he's probably listening to Spanish programs, Spanish radio or Spanish television to get his news. And I'm wondering if you would know if those, you know, outlets are giving out as much information as all the other English speaking.
Sure. Especially in places like South Dade, especially in places like Homestead. I think, you know, the media, the radio stations, the local community newspapers there, they're getting that information out, as are groups like We Count that are situated down in the centrality of migrant communities like that. So yeah, I think they are informed, but again, as Oscar points out, there's still this lingering distrust precisely because they're seeing that contradictory signal. They're hearing on the one hand that ICE is going to be holding off on arrests of undocumented migrants like them, yet they're hearing about detentions of migrants like that, like Paulino Gallegos anyway.
Yeah.
And I should mention that Paulino was released on his own recognizance over the weekend. And one of the reasons may have been, we're not sure, but one of the reasons may have been that he is a diabetic. And as a result, his immune system is weaker and therefore more vulnerable to infection by the coronavirus. That might have been one of the reasons why they let him go.
Yeah. And I want to get into this too, when it comes to detainees and again, the fear of spread of the virus. But Alina, you know, as Tim pointed out, with hospitals, with clinics like this, I thought my understanding was that ICE doesn't go to these places. But this is a concern, right? That, well, I don't want to go to a doctor because maybe ICE is going to be there.
Yeah, I mean, it is a concern of a lot of people. They did come out and publicly say that they wouldn't be doing that during these times. But I think not just myself, but a lot of my colleagues and, of course, all of my clients are very weary of taking ICE at their word sometimes.
Yeah. Maria, you mentioned a little while ago, too, about trying to do something about the issue of, you know, with people who are detained and because there are different places that they're being held. But trying to get people released, depending on their situation, especially when we're talking about health. But what have immigration officials said about, you know, if there's somebody who looks like they've got symptoms, who looks sick, you know, what they're doing with them? What are they doing with them?
Louis, we have confirmed cases of COVID in all of the detention centers, and yet they're not releasing, as the lawyer mentioned, people who could be at home safe with their families. This is absolutely immoral, given that folks are there in civil confinement, don't have any kind of public threat to the community.
Are they even separated? Are they separating these people from everybody else, though?
No. In fact, they're putting people in pod one in Chrome. There's over 70 people together. And the measures, there's very little measures of security. And frankly, for the guards themselves, that the guards don't even want to be in there. So detention is immoral, and it should be abolished, and it's very costly, and it's really dividing our Floridian families. And it's crazy that we would have people behind bars during this time. It's absolutely crazy.
There have been health officials who have sent Vice President Pence a request, if I'm not mistaken, to have a lot of these folks, these detainees,
released. There's lawsuits, there's sign-on letters, there's petitions. Even in Palm Beach, there was a drive-by honk protest that Florida Cares did for the decarceration up there, and I'm talking about both immigrant detainees and those who are being held in the criminal justice system for the most minor or the lowest or ridiculous bails that are unaffordable. And we are coming together to demand the recognition that we are a human family and that we are interdependent and that our well-being is connected to each other. And nothing like this, as we're hunkering down in our spaces with our families, to understand that everybody has the same needs and deserves the same opportunity.
Alina, have you had clients or have you heard from anybody who's found themselves in that situation? And what kind of stories are you hearing about what's going on?
I'm hearing a lot of crazy stories, to be honest with you. It's very difficult to get someone out of detention right now. We do not feel like they're making any special exceptions for anyone. I've even heard of a gentleman detained at Glades Detention Center who is HIV positive. I've heard of people with some serious medical concerns. And while they normally are treated in detention, it's absolutely crazy to have them in this sort of confinement around so many other people. These are people who could die. I mean, anyone can die from contracting COVID-19, but specifically when you have vulnerable people with medical conditions, they absolutely should be released. There are lawsuits that have been filed. As she said, there are petitions that are being filed. We've seen in some detention centers, not in South Florida yet, but we've seen a couple of people released when they've had more confirmed cases internally, but very few here in South Florida. I am hearing lots of these stories.
What are you telling people? Because there's a distrust. There's a fear and a distrust. So what exactly are you telling people?
As far as the detention centers?
The detention centers, but also just people, even people like Paulino, you know, just going out and about, you know, or if you think you need to go to a doctor, you need certain services. What are you telling them about how to go about this?
You know, I mean, health is first and foremost, right? We have to take care of ourselves. So I can't ever tell a client, don't get medical treatment. But at the same time, I urge them to have the same precaution that they have any other day, whether it was during COVID-19 or not, because ICE is proceeding business as usual from what we can tell, despite what they're saying. So everything you would do to be careful, not during this time, they should still be doing.
And Maria, briefly, one thing that you want to tell people now about, you know, what they should know.
Well, I think the immigrant community is well informed of and really makes it a business to get informed. I think for the broad audience that WLRN has is to understand what Tim said. These are essential workers and part of our families, and that they deserve driver's license, they deserve a path to citizenship, they're guest workers that are getting deported back. We have like 25 Cubans that have been moved around from detention center to detention center, these Haitians. We can't stand for this, and we need the leadership of this county to once and for all stand with immigrant families, and that has not been the case. Friends of Miami-Dade detainees and United We Dream and We Count and FOM, Miami Workers Center, many of the members, New Florida Majority, many of the members of the Florida Immigrant Coalition working very closely with communities right now to love and protect each other, but also organizing for advocacy, because we need not just the short-term change, we need some systemic change that addresses some basic human needs like healthcare and housing and the facility to live with freedom and without fear. And that's why I want to encourage people to connect with the Florida Immigrant Coalition.
Yeah.
And the hotline for volunteers, for information, or for donors, I can say it right now if that's a good time, is 1-888-600-5762.
And we'll get that on our social media as well. Tim, I'm going to
thank you for your work during this critical time.
Oh no, thank
unprecedented time.
It is our job. Tim, I'm going to finish up with you. As you said, Paulino was released. Right. I don't know if you've had a chance to talk to him. I wonder, you know, with everything that's happened, I mean, how has it altered his life more than it already is?
Well, in both good and bad ways, I think he feels, on the one hand, this detention has exposed him now to legal action with the by the federal government. He's hoping now he doesn't get deported. What he's hoping is that this will now allow him to adjust his immigration status, particularly since, as we said before, he has a child here who's a U.S. citizen. So that could be a silver lining for him. Actually, it could take him out of the undocumented shadows, as it were. Another silver lining that he's hoping with all of this is that because, as we said, these undocumented workers are now considered essential, that perhaps this whole episode is going to, in the long term, change U.S. attitudes, Americans' attitudes a bit about undocumented workers, who they are and what they do here, and the extent to which, as we've all been pointing out, we do need them in things like our food supply chain.
And I can just mention real quickly that my father, who's retired but spent many, many years working in Florida agriculture, has reminded me this is peak season. So this is when a lot of the food is being picked. We've been talking with WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. Also heard from Alina Santana, local immigration attorney and vice president of the South Florida's chapter of American Immigration Lawyers Association, and Maria Rodriguez with the Florida Immigration Coalition. Thank you, everybody, so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, still to come, we're going to meet a UM doctor. He may have found another way to help patients that need ventilators. That's coming up next.
She's a bright star, shining in a dark sky.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, one of the critical needs we've heard from governors and public health officials across the country, ventilators. Coronavirus attacks a patient's respiratory system, and ventilators can be essential in supporting healthy breathing. A University of Miami pulmonologist is studying a new treatment that could reduce the need for ventilators, if proven successful on a large number of patients. Dr. Roger Alvarez is exploring the use of nitric oxide therapy. Don't worry, we'll explain that in a moment. Dr. Alvarez, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
You regularly see COVID-19 patients both at the University of Miami and Jackson Hospitals. I wanted to get a sense of who you see, though. Who are these patients? Young, old, more male, more female? What could you tell me?
Well, in general, I can only speak directly to my experience, but it largely matches what you're hearing in the media reports throughout the nation, which is to say a broad spectrum of patients. They tend to skew older and with comorbidities, but we definitely have younger patients as well. And the younger patients mostly have comorbidities, but not all. We have some otherwise healthy patients. And yes, it's true that men do seem to be affected more seriously with the disease, although we do have women who have been admitted as well.
And of course, you know, some of those earlier reports were that this hit elderly a lot mm-hmm. more, a lot more than younger patients. But we've also seen that patients of many ages have passed away because of this. And I wonder, you know, the severity of the virus, how that differs from patient to patient that you've seen.
Well, I think that it's still true that older patients are more likely to succumb to the COVID disease caused by the coronavirus. They're more likely to die from it, especially with comorbidities. But because the disease is becoming so widespread, despite the fact that if you're older, you're more likely to get critically ill, if enough young people get ill, then a small percentage will be critically ill. And I think that's what we're seeing.
So I want to talk about this treatment that you tried, this nitric oxide. But first, we have to understand how the virus impacts our respiratory system. How does COVID-19 attack the lungs?
Well, I have to tell you that we are still learning more and more every day around the country and around the world about how this disease is somewhat unique. But like other respiratory viruses, the COVID or the coronavirus that causes COVID enters through the lining of the respiratory system. So the respiratory system starts in your nose, your nasal passage, goes all the way down into the lungs, into the small sacs of air called alveolus. And it gets into the lining, reproduces there. Initially, before you get an immune system response, it really reproduces very rapidly. And then after being in your upper airway for a while, several days later, descends down into your actual lungs, and where it seems to infect both the lining of the lung, what we call epithelium, and then also the blood vessels in the lung do seem to be affected.
Why does it seem that, you know, or at least what we know, right, that a large mm-hmm. portion of people who get it barely ever show symptoms, and some it will be severe?
Right, and the honest truth is we don't entirely know what is the difference between these people. Certainly people who already have heart disease and lung disease have always been at higher risk from complications from infections in general, just because their bodies are a bit weaker, their organs are you know, in rougher shape. But there's something about this virus that still does affect some younger people and not others. And it's true that the vast majority, especially of younger people, will have some will have mild symptoms and others will have moderate symptoms where they feel pretty crummy, but don't necessarily have complications from it. So it's only a small percentage, but it's when you have enough people get infected, that ends up being a lot of people.
So when you have those severe COVID-19 patients, why are ventilators often needed?
So when this virus attacks the lung, it is causing what is commonly known as pneumonia. That is, there's inflammation and there's fluid accumulating within the air spaces of the lung. This disease also seems to affect the blood vessels themselves in the lung. And so the whole job of the lung to begin with is to bring air into close contact with blood so that we can get the oxygen into the blood. When COVID and other diseases affect the lung in this way, they lose the ability, they lose their efficiency at exchanging that oxygen. And so we have to deliver high concentrations. What's been interesting but also concerning about COVID is the degree to which the people have trouble getting enough oxygen. And it requires high doses of oxygen. And sometimes high doses of oxygen are ineffective. As long as your mouth is open, no matter how much oxygen we blow at your face with the traditional devices like what we call the nasal cannula, the prongs you see in the nose, if you get air from the environment, that only has 21% oxygen, right? So finally, the ventilator is most useful in that you're able to seal the airway and give 100% pure oxygen, and you're able to pressurize it to help pop open any lung areas that have collapsed. And so that's the main reason.
All right. So nitric oxide comes into play now. And right. And we have to be clear, this is very different than, because I know you've probably heard it, right? Very different from nitrous oxide.
Right.
So people
right.
understand the difference between the two.
Yes.
We think of nitrous oxide. That's the what we get when we go to the dentist.
Yes.
Nitric oxide. What does it do exactly? How does it help people who, again, are not getting that oxygen?
Well, I'll start by saying that nitric oxide, and thank you for mentioning the nitrous oxide. That's one of my favorite things about being a nitric oxide biologist, is getting to start every conversation with a joke about nitrous oxide and laughing gas. That's a good gimme that I get. So I thank you for planting that. I appreciate it. But you're right. It's not laughing gas. And it's certainly no laughing matter. Forgive the pun. So basically, nitric oxide is made by our bodies in a variety of cells, mostly in our blood vessels. That's the primary place. It's also made by some of our white blood cells. And it has a lot of different functions throughout the body in general. In the blood vessels, it's a signal to the artery, which is basically a tube that's lined by some lining cells that's called the endothelium. And then it's circled around by muscle. And the muscle is what allows the blood vessels to constrict and slow down blood flow, or open up and allow more blood flow. Nitric oxide is one of the most important signals to that muscle to relax and open up to allow more blood flow, right? Nitric oxide as a therapy has been approved for many years by the FDA for the treatment of little babies that have a condition called persistent pulmonary hypertension of the newborn. And it's life-saving therapy for those babies. And it's used around the world as a rescue therapy, meaning when people have severe pneumonia with very low oxygen and they're placed on the ventilator, sometimes even the ventilator is not enough. In that case, we add nitric oxide. And by opening up those arteries in the lung, especially in the areas of lung where the oxygen's being delivered, it brings the blood close to the air, right? More surface area for that, and more oxygen in the blood. So we know that it works for that.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's what's been done up until now. And then, I'll tell you about what I'm doing that's a little different.
Okay. Again, we're talking with Dr. Roger Alvarez at the University of Miami, a pulmonologist, and he's looking at the efficacy of nitric oxide in treating coronavirus patients. You could read more of the coverage of the pandemic, by the way. Go to WLRN.org/coronavirus. Do you believe, Dr. Alvarez, that nitric oxide could be an effective treatment? Is it a replacement for ventilators or just an addition to?
So it's already being used in addition to. So plenty of centers around the country, including the Massachusetts General Hospital, people in Italy and in China, have used it in addition to the ventilator for people who, despite the ventilator, still can't get enough oxygen.
Right.
That's not been formally studied, but I think most people would agree that it at least brings up, most physicians and intensivists agree that it brings up the oxygen. Now, what I've been trying at the University of Miami is a little bit different than that rescue approach or that in addition approach. So I worked with a sponsor, a company that's engineered a very small device. So mostly inhaled nitric oxide is given in an intensive care unit. It's a massive multiple 100-pound device that requires intensive care unit monitoring. And you guys have heard about, I'm sure, the limitation of intensive care unit beds and staffing, right?
Right.
So what this device has that's different is that it is a small device about the size of a lady's purse that conserves the nitric oxide by delivering it in little pulsed doses, right? So in the beginning of each breath, the device senses that you're breathing and it delivers a small amount, a measured amount of high concentration nitric oxide. So the device is meant to be used at home. So it's extremely simple to use. I have patients on it at home right now, not for COVID, mind you, but for another condition called pulmonary hypertension.
You did try this on a COVID patient.
Yes. And so basically, because I have patients involved in a trial of this device, which is still not FDA approved, but in a trial for pulmonary hypertension, when the COVID pandemic really came to Miami, I was seeing young patients, for example, who were looking okay, except that their oxygen levels were profoundly low. And we were having to place these patients on the ventilator for the oxygen for other parameters. They weren't struggling to breathe. They just couldn't get the oxygen. And so I thought that this would be a great opportunity to try to use this device, because this drug, by delivering nitric oxide, has been shown in other cases to improve the oxygen level. And if it was able to improve the oxygen level, could potentially avoid the need for ventilator in those patients for whom we were doing it for the oxygen.
And this patient recovered.
Yes. Yeah, so the first patient did in fact recover. He was on a disease course that looked like he was going to progress to need the ventilator. He was not needing it yet. Or I certainly wouldn't have used the experimental therapy. But I called the FDA and got approval to do what's called an emergency expanded access use. And we gave him the nitric oxide. 5 days later, he was discharged from the hospital on no oxygen.
All right, so now, and only because of time, you know, the thing is this. How do we know that the therapy worked and this wasn't just a patient who recovered on their own?
That is a wonderful question that I'm so glad you're asking. The reality is, like many other therapies, we don't know. And we don't know that that's the reason that he recovered. You're absolutely right. And so when we do therapies like this, there's this effect we sometimes call the Lazarus effect. Someone looks like they're going to die. We give them a medicine. They improve. We assume it was the medicine. If they die or get worse, we assume that it happened despite the medicine. And the only way we can answer your question is to do a randomized controlled trial. And so that's what I'm currently actively working on today with support from the University of Miami, who's provided me a small grant to actually do a randomized trial, as well as support from the sponsor to really learn if this is helping these patients.
And with the trial, what's the sample size you have to have where you could say, yeah this is effective, this works, or you know, it doesn't?
That's another great question. It depends on how much it works. So the more a therapy works, the more the degree of effect, the smaller the study you need to see the effect, right? Or to prove it statistically. So what I'm proposing to do first, as an investigator at one site, is to study a small group of patients, 12. And I probably won't be able to see a difference in things like mortality. If we do, that would be incredible, and it would mean the therapy is extremely beneficial. But I'll be looking at things like oxygen, heart function, the need for the ventilator. And if those things show a signal that it, you know, of significance in the right direction, we'll then roll it out into a larger multi-center trial.
If this is successful, how do you envision it could help reduce the strain on hospitals? Because this is all we keep hearing about now is the need for ventilators.
Well, so to the extent that it helps avoid the need for ventilators, that would be great for two reasons. One is the ventilator is not a panacea for this disease. Plenty of patients go onto a ventilator, and as you may have heard, you know, many still don't make it. So avoiding the ventilator entirely would be excellent. And the second thing is because this device is portable and doesn't require special monitoring, it could be started in the hospital. But if people are stable and beginning to improve, they could be discharged with it potentially and go home with it to finish the treatment, unloading the hospitals.
So again, as you said, this right now, it's just about getting this trial set up.
Exactly. Yes. We first need to learn, does it work? And all of those patients will be in the hospital for the duration of their treatment.
And how long will this take? Because as you know, this is all a race to try to beat this pandemic. How long do you think those trials could take?
Well, I think that when you use outcomes like I'm doing, where you look at the patient's measures of how much they're improving, you can start to get a signal with a small number of patients. And we can do that fairly quickly as long as we have enough support and help. And as long as patients who are sick are willing to participate, given, you know, we're only recommending treatments that we think will be helpful.
Yeah.
And so if we enroll quickly, I think something like a month, we could begin to know an idea of whether this helps in the next 2 weeks to month.
This is so fascinating. Dr. Roger Alvarez, pulmonologist at the University of Miami. You know what? I mean, the best of luck to you, but we're going to keep in touch. I want to see how this plays out.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Definitely.
All right. Thank you.
Well, still to come, how do you get married during a pandemic? A Key West couple finds a solution, and they get help from online strangers. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. You know, this coronavirus has impacted some pretty important personal events. I bet you for you, I know for me. I mean, think about things like, you know, bar mitzvahs that have been canceled, upcoming graduations canceled, birthdays. I didn't get to celebrate my birthday this year. WLRN's Nan Klinger spoke to a couple in Key West who are getting married this Sunday. They're not canceling the wedding. They're just moving it to the web, and they're doing it with the help from strangers online. By the way, this story originally aired last week.
Lizzie Hoke and Celine Picot got engaged last fall during a camping trip in North Carolina.
We had a ceremony, kind of a ritual, under some really tall trees and kind of proposed to each other.
After a few nights around the campground, drinking a bit of whiskey and by the fire, we decided that, and we talked about it, and then we decided it was time.
They live in Key West, and their plan was to get married here the weekend of April 11th. Celine's family was coming from France. Lizzie's was coming from Ohio, and they have friends from around the world.
Yeah, we were going to have a whole
weekend. We prepared a weekend of activities.
A little sailing trip and lunch on the water for the out-of-towners. A cocktail rehearsal reception for family and close friends the night before. And on Sunday, the wedding at the Key West Tropical Forest and Botanical Garden. With a band, florists, caterers, the whole thing. Coronavirus canceled that plan, so they started working on how to include those far-flung friends and family with technology.
I looked at Zoom and Facebook Live, and then there's Twitch as well.
The best option, they decided, was YouTube Live.
We just wanted to make it so easy for people who maybe don't really use computers at all much to be able to just click on a link, and it would take them to a screen that was the video in real time. And that's what YouTube is made for.
In France, they've been in confinement. So most of my family, they're separated. I have one sister in one place, another one. You know, the kids, they might be okay with Zoom, but then one of my sisters, Zoom is not going to work for her. Since they cannot even gather, you know, and be together to watch it, we're trying to really make it simple. Even to the point where my nephew could drop the iPad at my mom's door, and then my mom just pick it up and just presses the button.
To be able to actually include them in real time and to feel witnessed in real time, it's the best possible option at this point.
My mom said she'll wear her dress.
The dress that she was going to wear to your wedding here?
Yes, to watch it at home alone. Yeah.
The only problem with this plan was that Lizzie and Celine would need a YouTube channel with 1,000 subscribers to be able to go live on mobile. They are not YouTubers. So Lizzie started a channel and they posted a video.
So we need your help to please subscribe so that we can go live and share our ceremony with our friends and family.
Please. Click on the button. Yes. Subscribe. I did it, and I'm not very techie.
A little over a week before the wedding, their YouTube channel now has more than 600 subscribers.
Just kind of, I think, the best side of social media. To me, that's been a really beautiful thing that's come out of this.
They still need a few hundred more. Lizzie and Celine say they know they are blessed to be safe and healthy, to have jobs when so many are suffering in the pandemic. But it still hurts to give up on their plan for their celebration.
It's sad. Like, there are moments of sadness when, you know, to have to let go of the community coming together, our friends, and you know, our family meeting and all of that.
Our families never met. Our families have never met.
And the part that people were making the effort to come from all over.
All over the world.
Yeah, it was so beautiful to see that people would actually have a heart movement to do that and follow that. And that, you know, not being with them, it's just... Yeah, that's sad. That makes me sad when I think about it that way, and then we have to go with it, right?
Yeah.
They still hope they can bring together all the people they love.
So Lizzie always had the dream of getting married at camp up in Vermont, and for me it was always Key West. So we were trying to bring these two together. So we'll get married here because we want to get married now. And then next year, hopefully, next summer, we'll go to camp and reinvite everybody, and hopefully they can come.
That's the dream. August 2021.
You can see Lizzie and Celine's YouTube video at WLRN.org. And if you want, subscribe to their channel so they can have their wedding live online. I'm Nancy Klingener in Key West.
Lizzie and Celine's plan now is to get married in their backyard. And since the story aired last week, guess what? They made their goal. That's thanks to Donna Cutler in Miami Beach.
I was really touched at the outreach, and I went to YouTube and I subscribed, and I was actually number 1,000, which means that they can open up their channel to the public. But I would have done it if I was the second 2001, you know, if I was 2001. I wanted to do it just to help them have a happier day.
Well, the couple's friends and family around the globe will be able to watch the wedding, and congratulations to both of you to a happy ceremony and, you know what, to a happy life together. Share with us, by the way, your story of adapting to this pandemic, be it a baby shower or birthday party or quinceanera, whatever it is. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear your story. Well, that's the program for this Tuesday, April 7th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, many people are vulnerable in our healthcare system during this pandemic. Civil rights activists are concerned about disabled people, especially as hospitals may be forced to ration care with dwindling medical supplies and staff. Plus, how are you celebrating Passover, Easter, or Ramadan differently this year? Well, tomorrow we've got a panel conversation with people from different faiths to discuss religion during these difficult times. And we want to hear from you. Again, find us on Facebook or Twitter, or email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. We're going to try and incorporate your comments during tomorrow's conversation. And by the way, you've been listening to singer-songwriter Adrian Z. All programmed based out of Key West. We're going to continue to highlight South Florida musicians. You know what? Go to WLRN.org and look up Live from the 305 Season 2. I'm Luis Hernandez. Again, always stay safe. Keep that distance between people. We're going to get through this. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.